Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. I thought a really cool place to start with you, because a lot of real estate entrepreneurs that I speak with, they don't always have this big institutional background like you have, and then go into an entrepreneurial family enterprise or family-ish business. So I'd love to hear more about your transition from working for a really big real estate firm and now doing what you do. And maybe you can talk about your experience in real estate coming up as part of that story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and it was a great education, learn by doing. And that approach to business and life, the learn by doing approach, is one that I really champion and lean into. So my first job out of college was at PGIM, Prudential Global Investment Management. And I was on the private equity real estate investment side. So I was investing JV equity at PGIM from our institutional investors, right, like CalPERS and CalSTRS, in joint ventures, mostly with apartment developers. But I also worked on like hotels and office, actually did a data center deal. So I got great experience before I came to join the family business. And I think that goes a long way, right? So I learned a lot about underwriting. More importantly, perhaps I learned how to present deals to equity. Being on the equity side, I knew what we wanted to see, both in terms of presentation and metrics and returns and the pitch, you know, positives of the deal, what the mitigants are. And so I took that information with me when I joined Laterra. But in any event, I was at Prudential for 7 years. So I joined in 2008, right at the start of the Great Recession. I was there for 7 years. And when I came down to Laterra, at the time, I was 30, and I called it the 30-year interview. And that's just a bit of a joke, but I joined the family biz, right? So I went to work with my dad down in LA, which has been amazing. And we've really, you know, grown quite a bit and accomplished a lot. You know, nothing's easy, but we've had some fun doing it. So anyhow, so I think now when I go and I meet, whether it's capital partners or investors, right? Lenders, you know, attorneys, architects, anybody in the business, I think it gives me a bit more credibility that I came from PGIM and that, you know, I rose to the position of being like a director there. And so it's, you know, otherwise it's like if the kid comes right out of college, you know, and goes to work for the family, a lot of times it's like, oh, did the apple fall far from the tree? Like, we don't know, like, you know, so nepotism, right? It's always hard to get around that. So anyway, I think that was helpful. And I also came with some good contacts and relationships that I was able to leverage. So I think for me, that was the right path.
Did some of your colleagues at Laterra think of you, I don't know, like in a different way, almost like you've been somewhere maybe we've never been? Or are most of your colleagues at Laterra coming from institutional backgrounds?
Yeah, so that's evolved. When I joined Laterra in 2015, I believe we had, you know, I don't know, like 6 employees or something, right? It wasn't many. And so at the time, I was, other than my dad, who had an institutional background, you know, and my stepmom, a true family affair. She's an attorney. And I guess our CIO at the time too had an institutional background, you know, but a lot of like that was about it. So I think, yeah, yes, I brought a unique skill set on the acquisitions and capital markets side, which folks viewed as being advantageous. And I immediately put that to work in terms of raising capital for Laterra, you know, from these big institutions. So that was helpful. Today, if you look at our company, we've got 40 employees, about 20 on the development side, another 20 on the construction side, because we have an affiliate general contractor. And now a lot of our employees do come from institutional backgrounds, right? Because we've grown, you know, quite a bit.
When you were at PGIM, what was it like behind the curtain? Because a lot of entrepreneurial real estate people, for whatever reason, they always want to do deals with a large institutional firm. What was it like being at that seat, being in the investment committees, picking partners, turning partners away? Give us some insights.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, right? I certainly learned a lot during the process. I learned how big institutions think. You know, I learned that there's groupthink, right? So when I joined in 2008, it was the beginning of the global financial crisis. So there was a period of time where we didn't do any deals. We did like none in 2009. It was all workouts. So I got to do loan workouts and, you know, other restructurings. And so I learned a lot during that process. And then come like 2010, I think we did 2 deals, and then it slowly started to ramp up again. You know, so I think some of the things I took away from that were, one, definitely there's groupthink amongst capital partners, right? When one comes in, the rest come in. There's this idea that if nobody's doing anything, you know, why should we do anything, right? There's a little bit of a CYA, cover your ass mentality at the big institutions as well, you know, where people are thinking about their, you know, their job and their position and not wanting to take too much risk. I certainly met some amazing people there. I learned a ton. I met some great mentors, you know, so that was really helpful for me. People who I still, you know, keep in contact with today. Yeah. And, you know, listening to the investment committees was super interesting. Like I definitely learned a lot. One thing, you know, that as I'm talking, I'm thinking I remember the deals we did in 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, for example. We had a deal in LA. It was an apartment development deal. And I remember, I think the cost basis was like $300,000 a door. And I remember there was some hand wringing around that, like, you know, how do we feel about this basis? You know, do we think we're going to get out okay? Like, how do we feel about the rents? And today I was just kind of thinking through that. And I go, wow, that deal would cost $600,000 a door to build today. And I think Prue later sold it for whatever they did, $500,000 a door, and got, you know, some crazy returns. So it's, you know, with the benefit of time and having sat in that position, I realized that, you know, with some patience, probably 5 years from now, certainly 10 years from now, we're going to look back at our underwriting and our cost basis and our assumptions and our rents. And we're going to go, first, we were wrong, right? Everybody's wrong about their forecast. But second, my oh my, like, have things really increased since then? Costs, expenses, rents, revenues, exit values. So I kind of got the benefit of that, having seen so many deals go through committee across different product types as well. So that was, I think, quite interesting.
How important is the deal versus the sponsor for a new group coming in to a private equity firm? Is it more about them and their track record, or is it more about the deal?
That is a good question. And I think it kind of depends, like, you know, where on the fear, greed index we are, right? People are driven by fear and greed. In 2021, the meter was full greed mode, right? Now it feels like it's full fear mode, or at least it was. Maybe it's, I actually think it's inching up a little bit. And so I think if you're in the greed mode stage, or if investors are rather, I think it's probably more about the deal and less so about the sponsor, right? They're just looking for, at that, you know, point, they're looking for a deal that, you know, is in a location they want to be in a market they want to be in, that, you know, can deliver the returns that they want, because there's so much money they want to get out, right? And then I think as you move more towards, you know, the fear stage of that spectrum, or as investors do, I think then they really start to think more about, you know, the sponsor and their capabilities, and do they trust them to execute? Do they have a track record, and can they do it? I think that's how it works.
How are you thinking about dealing with institutions today, and how has that changed when you were on the other side? Meaning, like, has their strategy changed? Has their approach changed? Are you focusing on institutional capital now? Are you looking at other forms of capital? What does that look like compared to when you were sitting there back in 10, 11, 12?
Yeah. I mean, yes, we are looking at institutional capital. So to kind of give you like a little bit of background, maybe on Laterra and what, you know, how we've grown into where we are today and how we capitalize our deals. So, you know, we've got two verticals at Laterra, residential and self-storage. On the residential side, you know, it's probably fair to characterize us as one of the most active residential development companies in the southwestern U.S. We've got about 3,000 units in development currently, and that's a combination of multifamily and also build to rent. And so we used to capitalize our deals predominantly from these investment fund managers, right? Like, and that could be like a Carlyle, for example. And, you know, we still do, and they're a great group and institutions are great. But as we moved into like 2019, it occurred to us that it would be great if we could form a programmatic venture with a pension fund directly, right? If we could go directly to the source of that capital, we felt as though that would be advantageous for us, because we spend so much time talking to capital and pitching deals. So in late 2019, we got introduced to a Canadian pension fund, and we got a term sheet from them after they did a lot of work and a lot of diligence on the people and the company and our deals. And it was a long process. You know, that actually occurred over the second half of 2019. And then moving into 2020, we'd assigned term sheet and we were negotiating JV docs. And in my mind, I thought, what could happen? Like, nothing. This deal is going to happen. I'm really excited. Like, you know, unless there's like a war in North Korea, I go, this freaking deal is happening. Like, nice. I was very excited. And then the Black Swan event happened, right? Like, the NBA was canceled and Mark Cuban said, what's going on? And I go, oh shit, this is going to be a problem, right? And so that was, you know, that caused us to really, really work hard to convince this pension fund that this was the right strategy and we were the right group and this was the right market. So we closed on a $250 million commitment and went on to close our two seed deals and did a third deal. And that money's been deployed into three great projects. So that's how we capitalize our deals in many cases now, is with this programmatic venture with the Canadian pension fund, in addition to, you know, still working with the institutions. And then we also have the self-storage platform. In late 2021, we formed a JV with a group out of Australia, and they committed $300 million to this self-storage development venture. We went on to hire the head of development in the Western US from Public Storage to oversee that vertical. Then we had three seed deals that we had put under contract. This all happened kind of around the same time. And now we have this venture with the Australian group, and we're super honored to have them as a partner as well. I mean, that's more of a programmatic type venture at this stage. So that's kind of how we're capitalizing our deals today. But we've done deals with family offices. We haven't really gone hard into the syndication, you know, market, but, you know, it's, you know, maybe dabbled a little bit, you know, on a deal or two. And then on the family office side of the world is interesting, right? That's an area that we will probably continue, you know, to lean into. And then today, you know, there's a really great opportunity to buy existing multifamily assets for less than replacement cost. I don't like saying that as a developer, right? We're building all these projects, or they're leased, or they're stabilized, or whatever. I don't, you know, for me, It doesn't feel good to say that, but it's the reality, right? Values are down, call it 20 to 30% more, maybe in, you know, it's certain downtown markets. And so we're now thinking about not just thinking about, but you know, starting to put a strategy together to buy existing multifamily assets for less than replacement cost. And that source of capital would be, could be institutions. We've got a couple who want to go deploy capital into that space with us, but it could be family offices. We've talked to some, and it could be RIAs and, you know, private wealth managers and sort of, you know, go about it that way. So, you know, I'd say that's a very long way of saying we've capitalized our deals with different types of capital partners over the years, but it's been a bit of an evolution.
So I want to talk a little bit about how you started a self-storage vertical when you're known for multifamily. And then you don't do it kind of in a small way. You did it in a huge way. How did that come about?
Yeah, good question. And it's a narrative, you know, it's a question that we get often. You know, it kind of started, we have these great multifamily projects, right? And these tenants would come to us because they'd want to store stuff. And we try to, when we can, and we design our projects, like we want to make use of every square inch. So like we'll have some storage lockers or closets or whatever that we rent out, you know, to the extent we have room for them. But it kind of occurred to us that, hey, this is a really good business, right? So that was one thing. The second thing is that we learned with some research that Los Angeles is the best self, one of the best self-storage markets in the country. And that's objective. You can gauge that based on, you know, square feet per capita, right? How many square feet of self-storage exists, you know, per person in a 1 or 3 or 5 mile ring. And, you know, you want to be in the single digits. LA is like below 7, which is quite good. So we knew that was good. And then third, we do a lot of entitlement work. So we've entitled, I think, like 30 deals or over 30 deals, right? With a 100% success rate, knock on wood. One of the reasons why I'm, you know, going early gray, it's not easy. But what it occurred to us is that like we don't see, you know, CBRE or Eastdil or JLL, like email blast, like fully entitled self-storage deal, right? I mean, maybe every now and then, but that's a pretty rare thing. Whereas like an apartment deal, like you could see that all the time. And so as we were going through the entitlement process, we realized that if a site has a certain zoning, an M zone, for example, for manufacturing, housing doesn't work, but it does work for storage. So they don't compete. And in fact, they're synergistic, right? Because we can now direct people in our apartment projects to, you know, consider leasing a self-storage unit or other project. And, you know, they go together. You want to build storage near housing. So for those reasons, like it was an asset class that we thought and knew we wanted to get into. And that thinking evolved. So, you know, we were having some conversations with this Australian partner about, you know, creating a strategy around this. And they wanted to lean into it with us. And we had 2 or 3 deals that we were kind of circling that would form as good seed deals. So we put together this venture. I mean, we're really excited about it. And so we put together the venture. We had 3 seed deals. And then the next step was, this is great. We're multifamily guys. It's not, storage isn't, nothing's easy, right? I don't want to say that, but storage to build, you know, when you compare it to a multifamily project.
There's no rooftop pool.
Yeah, there's no rooftop pool. Come on. Very few windows and kitchens and MEP and all that. So it occurred to me that we needed to hire somebody to like oversee the vertical. So actually went on LinkedIn and identified this great person who was overseeing self-storage in the Western US for public storage. I sent him a LinkedIn message and I just said, the gist of it was like, we've launched a self-storage vertical. We raised $300 million. We want someone to run the vertical. We can align interests, you know, would love to talk to you, something like that. And he wrote back, we had a call and we hired him. I mean, it's a lot of work, but that's the quick summary.
And are you building these self-storage projects ground up, or are you taking existing buildings and converting them?
It's both. So mostly ground up. We've got a handful of deals now in Southern California, maybe 6 or 7. And then we also have a venture with the owner of Fry's Electronics, the big electronics store chain. We've got 3 deals with that family, the Fry family. And one of them is in Irving, Texas, which is just north of DFW Airport. And that Fry's site, we're repositioning the existing store into self-storage. So that'll be a reposition deal. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, those stores lend themselves pretty well, you know, to repositioning, right? You hear like adaptive reuse, office to residential, and that's a tough one. But big box retail to industrial or storage, like that's kind of a, I think that's a winner.
When you're negotiating directly with, whether it's a big pension fund or a big institutional fund, what have you found is their main sticking point, what they're really focused on, and how many levers can you pull as the entrepreneur, and particularly one that's been on the other side?
Yeah, I mean, it changes, right? Today, JV Equity for multifamily development is, you know, this is a pen, but their pencil's down, right? For effect. So today, like, that's a tough one. But once one starts getting back in or two, like they all will, right? And I think there's a bit of time for that, but it'll happen. So I think location is important. So I think having a good deal in a good location helps a lot. Obviously, the return profile is important. Like, you could get a development deal capitalized, maybe, if you could get to a 7 untrended return on cost. And I'm talking about in a great LA market, you know, so that's probably what it would take. You know, debt terms, you can get debt, but it's, you know, today it's like a lot of debt funds. We're in debt fund land, which is not a great, you know, place to be, but we're in that space. And so we're figuring it out. There are some banks we're still doing business with, of course, but so I think it's location and returns and product type. I mean, but I think it's like, it just evolves. You know what I mean? It just depends. Like today, like if you had a data center deal, you could get 10 bids and have a best and final round, and everybody would, it'd be like 2021 multifamily Sunbelt. You know what I mean? So it does depend on the product type, and that trend, those trends change over time.
How have you found a way in the toughest development market, I think, in the country? We've done 2 deals in California, 1 deal in LA, to get these things done in a timeline that makes sense, where you're still able to realize a positive investment?
Well, good question. We have a project in Burbank that's 573 units. It's an amazing deal in an amazing market. It took us 4 years to process entitlements for that project, 4 years. And, you know, now we've been, you know, then you got to do permitting, and now it's under construction. And I like to say, if I had my daughter when I first started working on that project, she'd be 8 right now, you know, and we're going to finish it at the end of this year. So it does take a really long time. I think, you know, I think it's kind of one of those cases of like, it's super tough, and therein lies the opportunity. So we're experts. We kind of think of ourselves as ninjas in this market. And we've done business in Albuquerque and, you know, Phoenix and Dallas and Sacramento. And, you know, so we're not exclusive to SoCal. And in fact, you know, as time has passed, we've done more and more outside of SoCal. But I think it's, you know, we have good relationships with really good consultants. We know a lot of the folks at the city and the planning department, you know, so that's helpful. We know the processes. We're collaborative with the neighborhood groups. We know how to work with them and ultimately get their buy-in, which I think is helpful. So I think it's a skill set that we've grown over time. It's a lot of experience, I would say.
Are the cities doing anything to speed it up for multifamily? Because there's all this talk, and we're not in multifamily, of this big housing shortage, but yet multifamily sometimes takes longer or as long as all these other product types. There's, you know, the not in my backyard groups. Is that changing, or is that going to be just how it is forever in LA?
It is changing. So within the state of California, there is a consensus that we're in a housing crisis. So it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, whether you're, you know, Democrat or Republican or whatever, everybody agrees that we need more housing. And so there has been a shift. You know, there's been political support and a shift in Sacramento to help stimulate housing production. And there's something called the Housing Accountability Act. And actually, Governor Jerry Brown passed it. Gavin Newsom enforced it in various ways, but effectively, or bolstered it. But effectively, cities have to approve your project now if it complies with all objective zoning standards. So if you have a project and you're not seeking a zone change or a variance, a city must approve you. And in fact, I was at a Santa Monica hearing, a planning commission hearing or city council, and there was a group that had a project ahead of us, and we had our project up for approval. And it was really interesting because the project ahead of us, the city, the council members were like, well, should we approve this project or should we reduce the density? Like maybe we should break the massing, the building into two. And the city attorney, like a really shy gal, she said, excuse me, council members, per the Housing Accountability Act, you have to approve this project. And they're like, excuse me, what? And like, then they get into this discussion and she's like reading this thing and they're like, wow. Like, and they were just like learning about this live on the spot. And then interestingly, then they turn to the developer and they're like, well, do you want us, should we call a vote? And he's like, yes. And they're all like, I approve. So it was like really interesting. But that doesn't take away the CEQA. I don't know if, CEQA is relevant for
this. Yeah. Well, but explain, like I had to deal with it on a project, but for those of you not in California, maybe you can give us a 1 minute summary of CEQA because it's not common in any other state.
Yeah, it's not common. So CEQA, is an environmental study that you have to do. Basically what it does is it requires public agencies and local governments to evaluate and then disclose environmental impacts of development projects. And then if there are impacts, like you have to try to avoid them or mitigate them to the extent possible, which sounds good on the surface. I mean, nothing sounds terribly wrong with that, certainly. But there's a couple issues, right? One, it takes a really long time. It can take 2 years to do what's called an environmental impact report, which is a big CEQA study. So that can take 2 years, right? That's a long time. But probably more disturbing is the fact that opponents can use CEQA as a mechanism to slow down or stop your project on really baseless grounds. And in fact, they can use it as a means to extract money. And the way that they do that is, they can put together, there's pay-to-play consultants who can put together a study on like sound or air quality or noise. And then they can, effectively cause your project to be slowed or stopped. I'll give you a more realistic example too, or a real example in my experience. You could have a union say, hey, there's a migratory bird called, the red-tailed gnatcatcher that has, at some point in history been shown to live in this market, right? And it's like, oh, wow. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, geez. And they appeal your project. And this is like in their letter, right? Their appeal letter. And then they're like, they leave you a message. They want to meet with you or call you. You're like, all right, you meet with them. And then it turns out like they don't care about the red-tailed gnatcatcher. They want money or they want you to use them or whatever, right? So then it's like you figure it out and then they withdraw their appeal, right? And so when you start to think about CEQA through that lens, together with the fact that we need a lot of housing in California, then you really start to scratch your head and go, is this the right tool? Right. So that's a challenge for sure.
How do you structure your land deals and your waterfalls with such a long entitlement process? What does that typically look like in your investments?
We've been pretty good. The Burbank example is an outlier. We've been pretty, because it was a zone change and it was Burbank. And so it took a long time. And we did a full environmental impact report. For our storage deals, we've generally been able to get those entitled in, say, like 9 months from when you submit the application. There are now tools to be exempt from CEQA. We just got a project, a 210-unit project approved in Marina Del Rey. There's a CEQA document called a SCIA, which stands for Sustainable Communities Environmental Assessment. But effectively, like it goes faster, and certain projects qualify for it. So that, that allowed us to get through the process a little faster. So it's not always that long. Like maybe the pre-development or entitlement period is like 18 months, still long, but not the 4 years. And typically what we try to do, not always, but in many cases, unless we're really getting a discount on the land, is we don't close until we've obtained our entitlement approvals. So we might put a site under contract, put up let's say it's a $10 million land buy. You put up a hard deposit, non-refundable of 3%, 300,000. And that gets you like 12 or 15 or 18 months to get through the entitlement process and the pre-development process. That way, like, it's not a big drag on your returns and it's not so capital intensive until you're ready to really like start construction. So we structure our land contracts that way, you know, most times. So that's one way to do it. And we almost always do that. Sometimes we'll buy entitled land, like if there's a way we can add value, right, to reduce that time period. And then, you know, what we try and do is like we factor that into our IRR calculations, right? And you want to still get even with that length of time, you want to make sure you're getting, let's say, a 20%, you know, project level IRR, then you're in the promote. If it's a long-term hold deal, like let's say our capital partner is a pension fund and they want to hold the asset over a long period of time, then we structure promote crystallization, right? Which effectively, for the listeners, you may know, but for the listeners, promote crystallization, effectively, it allows you to own an asset long-term, but monetize promote at stabilization. And the way that's done is when you get leased and stabilized, you come up with a hypothetical value, either you and your partner agree on it, or there's a three appraisal process. And then that value is run through the waterfall as if it were sold. And then it's like, all right, if we sold it, like you'd make X dollars, and you can either get that paid out in cash under some structures, or the 90-10, for example, might be like a 70-30, right? And then it gets locked in or crystallized, and then that's the structure going forward. So that's another way to do it if it's a long-term hold.
What has typically been your strategy to hold things long-term as the family, or are you tending to sell and recycle capital into other deals?
So it depends, right? I mean, it's generally speaking, and our thinking has evolved a little bit over time. Today, our goals are to own assets longer, get cash flow and depreciation, tax benefits. And it takes so much work to entitle and develop and build and lease and own. You know, it's a lot of work. So then just to do all that and then sell it and then pay tax, you know, is not ideal. So we're trying to own assets longer term, and they, you know, and we are, we've been doing better at doing that. But sometimes it's like, it could be an opportunity fund LP, right? And that particular LP might be a closed-end fund and their goal is to hit, you know, high teens net returns. So they're like, we're build and sell, right? And that's, if you go into a development deal or any deal with an opportunity fund and that, you know, their short-term hold, like that's kind of is what it is. And then, but now we've partnered with groups that do want to hold longer. And so we've been successful in expanding our stable of capital partners to include like the longer term hold partners.
I'm curious to know in your deals, why is design so important? If you go on your website, if you're driven by any of your deals, if you follow you on Twitter, it stands out that your deals are very hospitality in nature. They're very design focused. Why is that so important?
Good question, right? And you know, design is critical, right? Especially when you're talking about the residential side. Storage too, but like for residential, it's super important. And that comes into play both in terms of the way that you design the buildings, how the buildings look, the actual floor plans, the units, including balconies and lots of nice open space and amenities, right, are super important. We try to put the pools on our roofs when we can, which takes structural steel, and that's more expensive. But a robust amenity package is really important. A cool interior design program and branding and even like signage, like all of that is super important. And at the end of the day, like the goal is to obtain strong rents, right? That's the goal. And in order to do that, you have to have the best product. So that's something that we've leaned into. And we do, like a lot of our projects do have that kind of like boutique hotel vibe. Not all, but that, you know, that has allowed us to obtain, you know, some of the higher, you know, highest rents in the submarket in some cases are up there. And that's, you know, that's important to us, like residents care. And if they walk in and they go like, wow, like this is dope, like they're going to, you know, you're going to be able to get a better rent. The last thing I guess I'll say on that too is that a lot of our, not all, but many of our peers, like let's say the development budget was like $100 million. That's a lot of money. Then you could, and you could build like a straight down the fairway, but nice, a class A product. Or you could spend $101 million and have something that's like really, really nice and different, right? 1% more. Now, don't get me wrong, $1 million is a lot of money and every dollar counts. But the ROI on that is typically pretty strong. Like that last like $1 million or whatever percent is pretty strong. So we don't like to invest $100 million on a project and then like save $1 million and not have it be wow, right?
What are the little items that you guys have figured out really drive that extra $1 million or convert it into an ROI? Like what are the little things that are kind of non-negotiables in your projects?
Yeah. So I think it's good interior design is important. You know, when you walk into the lobby, we like to have cool lobbies, right? When a prospective resident or resident walks in, you want it to be like, wow, like this is really cool, which could be like an Uber waiting area, you know, cool art or murals, just like a good, you know, a good place. And so we do that. Floor plans are like super important. Like if you have bad floor plans, you know, that can really impair your rents or your ability to lease certain units, which can be, you know, significant. We always like to put closets on the bedrooms, or I should say walk-in closets in the bedrooms, even at the cost of having a smaller bedroom. We found that, you know, and that might vary from market to market, but certainly in LA, but I think other markets, when you walk into a unit and whether, I guess that's the, you know, the girl or the guy, it could be probably both. They're, you know, wow, like that walk-in closet. Oh my God. Like that's one of the first things people say, like if the whole unit is like they comment on the walk-in closet. So I think for us, like that's important. And then cool roof decks, like you've probably seen that on Twitter. We like to say that we have some of the best roof decks, right? And we put money into that. And, you know, tenants love that. Like they want to have a space where they can like imagine like bringing their friends and hanging out, having happy hour, or spending the day on a Saturday, like by the pool on the roof, right? That kind of thing, you know, when residents see it, like it, we've seen them go like, okay, let's do it. I want to live here. Like let's sign a lease. Right. So that's important.
What have been the things that you did in the past and you're like, well, we're not going to do that again. It didn't really work out as we had planned, whether it's a design thing or an amenity thing.
Yeah. I mean, ground floor retail is probably an example of that. Although interestingly now, the ground floor retail is actually like picking up quite a bit. Retail's doing pretty well, but you know, that's maybe a moment, but you know, so we've in the early days, I'll say we'd underwrite like, you know, 90%. It wasn't a lot of retail. It could be like 4,000 square feet, like two or three or four at the most suites, you know, spaces, or even one, but like a lot of that stuff sits like half vacant. Right. So like now in our pro formas, you'll see like we're hitting it with a pretty high vacancy and pretty reasonable rents. So retail is one. Fortunately, the retail market, you know, is doing well now. In the past, like we haven't gotten all the floor plans done really well. Like we've hired like really good architects who've done tons of institutional multifamily buildings in the market. But even then, like sometimes the floor plans are not great and you kind of go, you know, what's going on here, right? So I think having a lot of focus on the floor plans is super important. And, you know, as time's gone on, we've gotten better at that. You know, so that's something that, you know, we've leaned into a little bit. And then there's other things too. Like it used to be like in 2014, 15, like having a theater, right? Like a big, a room with a huge TV and like, you know, 10, 15, whatever, really comfortable lounge chairs was a huge selling point because people wanted to watch the Super Bowl together or with friends, or movie night or whatever. And then like during COVID, it was like, nobody wanted those. Like they thought it was the craziest thing. Like, how am I going to, you know, go into this room with like 20 people, right? And then outdoor space became really important, and balconies. Like if you didn't have balconies, you were hosed, right? During COVID when you were leasing, and even now. But it sort of, it changes, right? Like now people want theaters, you know, again. So now we're doing them and people love it. So it changes, you know, it changes over.
If you weren't doing retail on the ground floor, what were you doing in place of retail? Or have you seen anyone do anything creative on the ground floor?
I mean, well, you could put units on the ground floor, depending on the product type. If it's you know, if it's a wrap where you have like, you don't have like a podium, right? You have a parking garage and units wrapped around it. You could just have units on the ground floor. If it's a podium where you have, you know, either below grade parking or above grade parking, you'd want to have, you know, your lobby, your club room, maybe your fitness center, put some amenities down there, and then parking. Like, you just put parking, right? And then have like a cool roof deck and with some amenities up there. But that's really all you can do. A lot of times it's the planning department at the cities who want to see this ground floor retail because they imagine this incredible environment where everybody's walking and people don't have cars. And right, I mean, and it's a good idea, but it doesn't always, you can't just like put retail at the ground floor of any building and like expect it to get leased, right? But I don't think the planning folks really think about that always.
I want to talk about the construction side a little bit, because I think in multifamily, there are some big examples of some self-performing groups, but there's also plenty of groups that don't do that. Why was it important to you to add a construction component? And when did that start? Was it always from the beginning, or did that evolve over time?
It evolved as a necessity. And so, and I'll drill down on that. It's initially we were using third-party general contractors. And I think the natural evolution of a developer, not always, but in many cases, is to start out without that function and then to conclude that in order to execute as best as possible, you need to control your own destiny. And that piece of the business is obviously so, so important. And, you know, without naming any names, we had some bad contractor experiences. And yeah. And, you know, at some point, like we started hiring construction managers, right? So we had our development team and our typical development people. But then we go, well, we really need like construction managers, different than the development guy. We're talking real, you know, people who really, really know construction, who are out on the job site. Eventually it was once a week at the OAC meetings. And I was like, no, we need people like there all day, every day at the job site. And we started doing that. And then like, we're like, wait a minute, we're paying for these people. And then they started kind of doing the job of the GC, not entirely, but a lot of it, right? And then it's like, well, we're paying the GC this GC fee and they have general conditions, which is their overhead. And then we out of our own pocket are paying these construction people. And we go, if we had a GC, like at least it would be a project cost, right? In the general conditions, which is normal in market. And there would be a fee, but it wasn't even about the fee. And it still isn't. It's about execution and it's about keeping the project on time and on budget as best as you can. That's a very hard thing to do. As best as you can. And like, I'll give you an example, like many GCs, if there's a change order during the construction process, and there always are, a third party GC will prioritize the execution of that change order as being like the most important thing. You know, so they kind of stop working on other stuff. And if you don't get it signed, like they could threaten to walk off the job. And then it's almost like, okay, so we either have to agree to eat this cost that we disagree should be on us, or, you know, you're going to slow our job down and cost us way more money than just signing it, you know? So none of that feels good. So then when we, and again, I'm not saying all GCs do this, but we experienced that. And so with our GC, like that never happens, right? It's sure there are change orders, but like we are project first, right? So there could be an unsigned change order and it's the project is the top priority. And this is kind of happening in the background, right? And we kind of figure it out. But that's an example, but you really want to control the process.
What's the best way to manage it? Like if you're the development person, if you're the leader at the firm and you're trying to manage the construction project and manage the development process, all for the interest of your capital partner, like how have you figured out how to do that if it's all one group?
So there is an inherent conflict there, but you have to weigh the pros and cons of that potential conflict with the benefits, right? And the benefits being, well, I just gave you a couple examples, but you know, other benefits include like not padding the budget, being able to really have the transparency to control and control over the subcontractors. And so you sort of look at it and you go, you know, pros and cons, right? and you have all these pros, and then you look at the cons, you go, well, con could be that if the GC has a change order, is the developer truly representing ownership in a way, you know, by trying to say, hey, no, GC, like, that's on you. You know, you got to pay for that. And within our company, our GC, it's an affiliate, but it's its own company, but it's an affiliate. And so the head of that division, who's fantastic, and that whole team, they are, their compensation and the way that they're rated and reviewed is based on the success of that entity. So it's, honestly, we sit down in a room with them and argue just like we would with a third party GC, right? It's really actually not different. So that inherent conflict is more perception than reality, but ultimately, like, you have to recognize it and address it, articulate it, and then start to look at the pros, and you go, wow, like, net, like, yeah, this is better still.
One of the mistakes we made early on was not having dedicated project managers full-time on site.
Totally. That's
to our development projects. And like, when we started out, like, we were smaller and, you know, like, principals would just lean in and that was it. But as you grow and you don't have time to be there and you have someone popping in once a week, or you're going to the OAC meeting once a week, it's not the same. And that was a big learning for us. And I suspect a lot of people as well. Are there any other insights that you've taken as you've scaled this platform along the way that maybe is different how your dad operated it in the early days?
I mean, there's probably a lot. There's a lot of lessons. Like, we're always learning and growing, and there's growing pains, and, you know, we change our protocols. And so I'd say that there's probably, you know, a handful of examples. You're right that, you know, earlier on, like, you know, the principals go to the OAC meetings, and, you know, and then eventually you realize, like, no, you need somebody there, like, the entire time. You know, but there's probably a manual of lessons. Actually, we actually have a lessons learned document. It's very long, but there's so many lessons. I mean, I'll give you a couple examples. The cheapest GC is the most expensive GC, right? So you get your three bids, and it's like, you know, one's 25 million, one's, you know, 27 million, and one's 19 million. You go, oh my God, this 19 one works so much better in the pro forma. Like, we got, you know, this is great. Well, that 19 is going to turn into like 30. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not the 25. You can hold those guys to 25, you know, 25 and a half, whatever. Like, but so the cheapest is not the best. And I'm going to say the architect may be even more important. You can have a great design architect who can create beautiful site plans and renderings and present to city councils and neighborhood groups, and people love them. That architect might not be good at construction drawings. And if you don't have good construction drawings, that is a recipe for major cost overruns and change orders, right? So having a really good design architect, as time went on, like, we would, in some cases, and we do now, get a third-party review of the plans. You know, there are people who will review the plans, a third party, and they'll say, hey, here's a scope gap. You know, this, you don't have this detail, like, in the corner, you know, design. Like, the GC's not going to be able to price it. They're not going to have anything in their budget for it. And then they're going to hit you with the change order, right? So having, like, the drawings reviewed is a big one. You know, it's the other thing I realized is, now I'm going to zoom out. Development is playing the game on expert mode. And do we need to do that? Should we play on, like, intermediate or easy, you know? And then you layer in, like, entitlements and development, and you go, it's a lot of work, you know? So, you know, another lesson is be diversified. Don't just do development in LA. And as time went on, we're like, oh, like, we have this self-storage vertical. That's great. And today we're so happy we do. We expanded into Dallas, and we have a build-to-rent project in Albuquerque. And, you know, we expanded just out of, like, urban infill into, like, suburban walk-up apartments. All of that has been really, really helpful too. The kind of, you know, you don't want to be too exposed to one product type in one market if you can help it.
Do you hire new teams for those different diversified activities, or do you kind of all pitch in and spread out to the different verticals as you bring them on?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, for us, like a growing company, like the revenues need to come at the same time as or around the same time as the expenses. A really big company, and we're not that. We're not now, and we never were. And by that, I mean, we don't have the luxury, I guess, of a massive company, you know, that can just like, all right, we're going to open a Dallas office. We're going to hire a partner. We're going to hire an acquisitions guy and a development guy. And then we're going to go find deals, right? That's a big investment without having any revenue or deals. Like most people don't have that ability, right? Some do. But so what do? Right? It's, you know, you got to gin up a deal in Dallas, in this example, and get it under contract and, you know, get the capital. And maybe you have a local consultant. We sometimes, well, not sometimes, we always will use like a local consultants and local people in that market. And you have to get a revenue stream either in place or, you know, coming. And then you can sort of make more of an investment on a permanent basis in that market or in that vertical, right? For a growing business. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing.
What surprised you most about the self-storage vertical as you're starting to spin that up?
Today, well, I would say a couple things. The support for self-storage by cities and communities is actually quite a bit less than it is for housing. Housing, like people generally, you know they need it and want it. Cities anyway. I guess local communities, the good thing about that is like there's no traffic impacts. Like if you might be turning like an ugly old like warehouse building that's like doesn't look great into storage. At least it like looks nice and you're doing landscaping and trees and it looks cool. Doesn't have a lot of traffic. So the community kind of doesn't care, but like a lot of these city governments, you know, they kind of don't like storage. They, you know, so there's a little bit of a finesse there and a way that you have to, you know, characterize and describe your project as being part of a neighborhood ecosystem. And it is. It supports the densification of housing, smaller units. People can create home gyms and home offices, put them in storage units, you know, more retail tenants, they can store inventory and stuff there. So you got to have the right pitch and narrative. But that kind of surprised me a little bit. But we figured that out quite well, I think. And then I think it's how much easier, knock on wood, they are to build. I mean, again, I don't want to say anything's easy or underplay it because it's not. But, you know, geez, like we're going two levels below grade in Santa Monica and shutting down the streets and concrete and whatever, however many stories you have with windows and kitchens and MEP. And, you know, the storage, it's like 12 months to build. It's like, wow, that's really fast. You sure? Yeah. Yep. 12 months. So like, you know, that's kind of nice too. That sort of surprised me a little bit, the speed at which you can build them, but they lease up slower, you know? So it's a little bit of a niche storage.
What are some of the practices that you learned from the private equity side that you've kind of embedded into your business today? And what are some of the ones where you did in private equity and you're like, yeah, we're definitely not doing that. That's a big waste of time or we're not doing it.
You mean as it relates to what? As it relates to
running the business, just like on the business, on the operations side, just building the business, building the firm. What are your internal practices and procedures like? And what did you take from the private equity side? And what are you kind of doing new on your own?
Yeah. I mean, on the private equity side, you almost don't have a really, I'll say this, the private equity people, especially those who have never run their own business, don't appreciate or understand what goes into running a business. They don't understand, you know, why does a developer want a pre-development fee during the entitlement stage? No. Well, unfortunately, I can't tell my development guy, when you go to Whole Foods, pay with promote. Just go to the checkout stand and just tell her, That'll be $218. Ah, I'll use a little promote, please, right? Like, nope, not going to work. So Like these private equity guys, they don't get that. You know, they don't understand that. And so like there's those discussions. They don't understand like, you know, that a lot of these smaller or growing or medium sized companies don't necessarily have, you know, all these departments, right? Like, you know, full HR departments or whatever, right? So I would say it's more of a lack of understanding or appreciation from them towards, you know, owning and operating a business and figuring out how can you do it in a way that's lean, but also in a way that you're covering all your bases and you have all the right, you know, people and chips in place. So, you know, I almost think it's the opposite. I almost feel like they just don't oftentimes like get it, right? I mean, you know, Jake, it's not, you know, it's not easy, right? It's not for the faint of heart.
Well, no, I mean, sometimes they, you know, they frustrate me because they'll say those pre-development fees or they'll say we don't charge acquisition fees, but then they're charging their own investors like an insane amount of fees. And the other frustration that I've also found with some private equity firms is similar to what you talked about in the beginning, and that's they seem to invest like in the crowd mentality, but the best opportunity that you're bringing to them as a boots on the ground operator at the right time, they maybe can't seem to get the conviction to do it. And they're always like a year or two late from the real on the ground entrepreneurial guy.
100%. I agree with both of those frustrations. It's, you know, if they have a $300 million fund or $500 million and they're charging a 2% annual asset management fee, that's a stable income stream that allows for hiring at a rapid clip. And those are big fees that their LPs are paying. And so, but then they get mad, like when the developer wants to charge a market rate fee to actually like pay their people, right? So, you know, that kind of thing is a good point. And really a lot of the folks who work at the private equity firms, probably I'd be surprised if they thought that way. I mean, the partners do, the senior folks do, but like a lot of the middle level and junior people, like they don't really think that way, right? Maybe because they haven't run a business before or whatever. You know, some people do. And so there's some frustrations there, but, you know, I've actually explained this exact thing to, you know, people at these institutions before. And I've used the promote and grocery example too, which actually my dad used. And it's funny. I mean, it gets the point across, right? Yeah. So there's, I'd say that's one of the frustrations. The herd mentality is the other point you made. And I agree, like they definitely have a herd mentality. And it's too bad because right now we are seeing some incredible buying opportunities, right? And it's like, geez, the fact that a lot of them won't get off the sidelines is frustrating because now is when the money is going to be made, the fortunes are going to be made. So that's why, you know, we're going to go find the money one way or the other. If it's not going to be these institutions, maybe it'll be family offices, whatever it might be. But I agree with you on those two.
Right now, the biggest opportunities you're seeing are what?
Today, well, I would say there's two areas where the capital is flowing in for us, for Laterra. I'll say two and a half. The first is self-storage, because you can still get the untrended return on costs that you need, the development spreads, right? I'll say it differently. You can get 150 to 200 basis points spread between your untrended yield on cost and today's spot cap rates. Not true in multifamily because it's expensive, more expensive to build than the rents aren't, you know, I mean, they're okay, but storage, pretty good rents, pretty cheap to build in the right market with markets that don't have a ton of supply. So storage is one. The other opportunity is buying existing multifamily for less than replacement cost. So that could be brand new multifamily or whatever the vintage. That's a really good opportunity. And there is capital for that, but there's not a lot of deals, you know, so that's a little bit tougher. The half I mentioned is we opportunity zone capital. I say half because that's starting to wind down because we're getting closer to the deadlines, might get extended, but also like there's not as many cap gains flying around as there was, right? So that's slowed that biz down a little bit. The other is, and we're not in this space, And in fact, it's actually, if you're not already, it's pretty hard to change that. But the data center space, there's a lot of opportunity there. But again, I think that's very niche-y and it's hard to just like jump into it, right? A lot of the established players, are running that. But anyway, so those are sort of some of the opportunities that we're seeing today.
On the existing multifamily where you can buy it for less than replacement cost, what are you thinking in terms of CapEx and assumptions going in? Are they pretty stable where they are? Are you guys completely transforming and doing a value add transformation? What does that look like?
So we're actually targeting newer vintage assets for that strategy. In fact, we're seeing projects that are like in the construction process, in the latter stages, and the sponsor is unable to, complete because they're in default on the construction loan. And the reason they're in default is because they get hit with these massive interest reserve rebalancing where the lender's like, all right, you got to fund $3 million to top off your interest reserve, right? That's a real difficult position to be in. And so they're in default. In some cases, the lenders are still funding because they go, you're almost done. Like, let's get it done. I don't want to foreclose, but then they force the sale, right? So we're seeing some stuff like that, which is kind of interesting. And then I think like these other kind of buy for less than replacement cost, generally like what we're looking at is newer stuff, not like the, 80s vintage value add deals, but I'm not saying we wouldn't, just got to be more conservative on like not buying blue sky income.
I want to kind of bring it home. And the last thing I want to talk about is family business, family dynamics. My dad's my partner in business. I came into the business. We had a smaller firm and we've now grown it. And I'd love for you to just riff on your experience and how you've made it work. Cause there's highs and lows, ups and downs, challenges. There always is, but I'd love to get your take on it.
I agree with that. I'd say net, it's awesome, right? But I think it's situational. I think I have some friends who are like, dude, I could never work with my dad. Like we'd strangle each other, right? That's that, and I get that. I've had some friends who are like, oh, that'd be amazing, and I get that. And I'd say overall, like, you have to maintain, professionalism as best you can. I think a little bit of it is like, sometimes you're like, my boss is talking to me like my dad. You're like, well, he is my dad. Or like, I think, and the inverse is like, you probably and me, probably like in some cases would say things or take a tone or deliver a message in a way to a parent that you like wouldn't do to a normal boss, right? Or they'd be like, why are you talking to me like, right? Because you're their kid, right? So there's always a little bit of that. Do you agree with that?
100%. And my dad and I had to go through coaching actually, because it got like too out of control, I think on both sides. And that was something we had to work on. So, you're spot on for my experience.
Yeah. And I've heard of, I had to, a buddy who just like couldn't, he had to leave. Like, he's like, I can't do it. Like, and so I think that's, that's not uncommon. So I think it takes, both parties, but the inverse of that. And, so there's that piece of it. And then there's the amazing piece of it that's like, outweighs the rest, which is like, these are really special moments. Like, if you look at a chart of the amount of time that most people spend with their parents as they get older, it's very sad. It starts high. I was thinking about my daughter. It's like, oh, how sad. It's very high. Then when they turn 18, it's like the hours, a month go very low. Me and you are very fortunate because here we are at whatever age you are. I'm almost 40, but it's, we're up here. Like we're seeing our parents as much as we did, or at least my dad, who I work with. And so like, that's like really special. And I also think when we look back, when we're older, we're going to say, wow, like that was really cool. I missed that. And so it's important to kind of cherish those moments. And then I think that like when you have a victory or a win, today wins are harder for all of us. But when you have them at any point, like it feels really cool, right? When, it's your parents and you can send them, text or give them a hug or whatever. So like, I think, that's how I look at it.
What about on the strategy side? Have you differed on strategy, or have you always been very aligned with where you and your dad want to take the business, whether that's investing or just what you want the business to look like?
I think generally aligned. I mean, there could be things we don't agree with, like a deal or like a submarket or, you know, like stuff like that, right? Or like a capital structure or like those types of things. Like I could see normal, but that's kind of normal, right? Like two different opinions. That's actually healthy, I think, right? To have, because otherwise, you know, if everyone's thinking the exact same, that might not be good. And so balances each other out. But from like big picture strategy, like we both were like equally excited about the storage vertical. We were both equally excited about some of these other markets we were looking at, equally excited about the venture with the Fries family, you know, equally excited about now trying to buy some existing assets for less than replacement costs. So, you know, generally like we're pretty aligned on that. And I think, you know, as he gets older and I get older, like there is like a slow, like gradual shift in the balance of power or however you want to define it, like, you know, because there's a generational handoff, right? And if we're lucky, it'll be gradual, you know, you and me collectively, right? With our parents, and anybody who works with their parents. And, you know, so that sort of, you know, happens too.
As you look forward 5 years from today, what would you like to be doing more of and what would you like to be doing less of?
I'd like to do more drinking gin and tonics in Spain, and I'd like to do less dealing with, you know, did the daily grind. No, I'm kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. I'm half kidding. Can we say I'm half kidding? Really.
I mean, I'm with you. I would do it in the south of France, not necessarily Spain, but I'm like there right with you. Let's go. But
you're with me on the strategy, right? No, I think, I mean, I'm of course half kidding. I mean, I do love what I do and you know, I work hard and I enjoy it. And I'm not trying to retire, but I do think like it can be a grind, you know what I mean? And when it's a down market, like people could be in worse moods. I don't mean at Latera, I just mean in the market generally, you know? And so that's, you know, that's always difficult. But I think to the extent, you know, I can outsource, not just, I don't mean outside of Latera, but like, you know, lean on other people to do more of what I do, which I feel like I do a lot. And already our team is doing an amazing job, but we've been growing. And so I've already been doing some of that. It'd be awesome to be, you know, able to spend even more time like on high level strategy and, you know, acquisitions and stuff, but, you know, not necessarily like reading a joint venture document and like, you know, going through the red lines on a Saturday at noon with our counsel so that we can get them a draft back on Monday and then spend 4 hours on a lawyer call with the other side on Tuesday. Like, you know, that's tiring. But like we do have a transactional woman who's amazing in-house who's been doing a lot of that. So I think as time goes on, right, you just want to figure out where do you add the most value and do more of that.
I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and that is, what's your favorite hotel?
In the world? No, in the country?
In the world, wherever you want. Pick one. Or two.
Oh my gosh. I mean, my wife and I went to Sicily and we went to this incredible hotel. I forgot the name though, but it was so beautiful. I like a lot of the European hotels that are like more smaller and boutique-y, you know. I don't like to travel and go stay at like the Four Seasons. Like, I want like a cool, nice boutique-y fun kind of vibe. But within the US, I really like the Petit Hermitage in West Hollywood. It's really fun. It has a rooftop pool. It's a really good vibe. Like it's just fun. Like I think it's a really unique and fun hotel. So, you know, that's probably right up there. Yeah.
I love it. Maybe that's all the inspiration for all these rooftop pools at your buildings.
It, you know what? It might be. It actually might be. You might be right. You might be right. By the way, the Standard Hotel in Miami and South Beach is pretty cool too, with that big beach landing pool. I don't know if you've been to it, but that's up there too.
A buddy of mine bought that hotel basically during COVID. It's probably one of the best hotel investments in Miami Beach. It's been performing incredibly and it's so cool. Like similar to that Petit Hermitage where you can't replicate the vibe and the pool and the hotel is like, okay, but it's the whole package is just a 10. Awesome. Thanks for doing the podcast, man.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. This was fun. I'm always happy to come back. So thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.